海紧缺人才培训工程教学系列丛书，英语高级口语资格证书考试，高级听力教程第二版，周国强、杨永平主编，由上海外语音像出版社录制出版。第六合
An Advanced Course of English Listening Second Edition。
Part 4, The Supernatural. Hi, Paul. What are you reading?
Oh, some draft article about a haunted house.
What do you mean, Daft?
Well, it's, I don't know, there seems some ghost there or something. I don't know.
Well, where is it?
It's just down the road, in Offley End.
Well, it's old enough. What's wrong with that? There probably are some ghosts.
Well...I don't believe in ghosts, frankly. Do you?
Well, yeah. I don't think we've got any proof that they don't exist. I mean, the number of people who've seen them, had experiences with them, I think it's a bit narrow-minded of you to say that there's no such thing.
Oh, well, I mean, I've had no evidence. I've never seen a ghost myself, and until I do, I shan't believe in it.
Well, Bruce, what about you?
I keep an open mind on it, really. If people firmly believe there's such things as ghosts, that's, up to them, but I would never sort of scoff the idea, or I would never turn around and say, oh, no, it's a load of rubbish, until you get absolute proof one way or the other, you know.
But you haven't seen one yourself.
I've never seen a ghost, but, it doesn't mean to say, 'cause I haven't seen one,that there isn't such things. There's lots of things I haven't seen, but they are about.
There's a friend of mine who's sort of spent all her life living with ghosts. I mean, I believe what she says, and she's got stories which don't just involve her, but, I mean, other people who've been involved with her ghosts as well.
I think people invent them. I think people want to believe in ghosts because their lives are so tedious, so boring, and etc., that they invent stories. I think it's a thing from the past when, you know, in the old days, people believed them because they don't have any scientific explanation for them.
Yeah, but how?
It's like I said before, it's always difficult unless you can. I'm sure there are times when you can, give a reason for what people think is supernatural. It may not be at all, which...I agree with you on that, but I am convinced as well that there are times when the scientists can't give an adequate explanation why this happens, and that's the time when, you know, when I think, well, if you've got to believe them in that respect, so...
Yes, well, I think scientists will. I mean, you take thunder and lightning. In the old days, they thought that was...the anger of the gods, right? Or it takes something like a magnet lifting up metal. I mean, it's amazing. It seems like supernatural, but now there's a scientific explanation for it.
But there are stories where you get people who, like yourself, who disbelieve them, and maybe even the scientists say, no, that's a load of rubbish. And then something happens on some occasion somewhere with them,where they completely change round the opposite, and they turn out to be believers.
And there's also the idea that people who so strongly disbelieve in ghosts, I mean, it does seem a little bit narrow-minded, but it also seems like basically they're frightened to admit there's something beyond their control. You know, I mean, it could just be that you're just too frightened to admit that there's something there, and you're not receptive enough, you know?
Well, that's your opinion.I shall continue to refuse to believe it until I have my own personal experience. Thank you.
Part 5. Listening and Translation. 1. Sentence Translation.
1. Six people were injured in the store fire, and firefighters rescued at least 5 people trapped on the roof of the burning building, fire officials said.
2. I'm optimistic and hopeful that at the next round of talks, we will be able to announce a permanent ceasefire in the Middle East.
3. Their defense lawyer told the press that his clients had complained to him they had been tortured, assaulted, and intimidated. They required urgent medical examination.
4. The reform we proposed would result in tighter control over the sale of alcohol. We would not see it sold alongside grocery items, but rather displayed in a separate, clearly defined area.
5. With the help of a page torn from a primary school atlas, a former Vietnamese naval officer navigated a small boat to Australia as an illegal immigrant.
2. Passage translation.
1. During the past 5 years, the number of Americans killed annually in car accidents has climbed to more than 55,000. The needless slaughter on streets and highways can be attributed to 3 general causes: mechanical failures, especially those related to faulty brakes and bad tires, account for a significant number of fatal accidents. Environmental conditions such as blind corners, narrow streets, heavy fog, intermittent rain or snow resulting in slippery roads also contribute to the accident statistics. But without doubt, the most frequently reported factors in car accidents are errors of human judgment, all the way from such follies as speed and drunken driving to such momentary lapses as failure to signal a turn or change from one lane to another. The man behind the wheel is often his own worst enemy.
2. In the years following World War II, the rate of population growth in the U.S. soared to an average level of 3.5 births per woman. By the 1970s, however, the birth rate was slowing down. In December 1972, the Census Bureau reported that it had dropped to about 2 births per woman, or what is called zero population growth. Even so, because there were many more women of childbearing age in the 1970s than there were in the 1950s, the Census Bureau estimated that by the end of the 20th century, America's population would reach 250 million. Unit 15, Part 1, Entrepreneurs.
Have you ever heard of these companies? Apple Computer, Atari, and the Federal Express Corporation? Maybe you have heard of them, but do you know anything about the men who started them? Well, Steve Jobs was a 21-year-old college dropout when he and a friend started Apple Computer in 1977. Today he is a very rich man, worth more than $150 million. Nolan Bushnell, the man who started Atari, became rich and famous in 1972 when he invented Pong, the first video game. At that time, he was 20 years old. In 1976, he sold Atari for $28 million. The third company, Federal Express, delivers packages anywhere in the United States in 24 hours or less. Its president is Frederick Smith. He is 41 years old. This young company is worth more than $600 million. What do Steve Jobs, Nolan Bushnell, and Frederick Smith have in common? Well, to begin with, they are all relatively young. Second, they are all rich. And most important, each of them became rich by doing something that no other person had done before. In other words, the Apple was the first home computer, Pong was the first video game, Federal Express was the first overnight delivery service. Steve Jobs, Nolan Bushnell, and Frederick Smith became rich and famous because each of them started a new industry. In English, we call people like them entrepreneurs. So, the definition of an entrepreneur is a person who organizes and manages a new business. Most of today's successful entrepreneurs, like the 3 I've already mentioned, are young. Some of them come from rich families, but others are poor. Some have a lot of education, but some, like Stephen Jobs, never finished college. As you can see, entrepreneurs can come from many different backgrounds. However, all entrepreneurs have one important characteristic in common. They are not afraid to take risks. You could say that they are all gamblers. American history is full of famous entrepreneurs. Let's meet some of the early ones. Francis Cabot Lowell, for example, created the first modern textile factory in the United States in 1813. Textile means cloth. Lowell got the money for his factory, $400,000, from his family and friends. He also invented a machine for making cloth. He became rich by selling cloth and copies of his machine. 4 years later, Lowell's business was making $34,000 a year. In those days, that was a lot of money. Another early entrepreneur was George Westinghouse. His career began in 1869 when he invented an air brake for stopping trains safely. Then, in 1886, he started the famous Westinghouse Electric Company. By 1900, this company was worth more than $120 million, and it had more than 50,000 employees. Have you ever heard of this company? It produces refrigerators, stoves, and many other electrical items. You have probably never heard of Edwin Land, but in 1937, he started the Polaroid Corporation in order to make lenses for eyeglasses. Then, in 1948, he invented the Instamatic camera. That was the beginning of a whole new industry. It made Edwin Land a very rich man. Today, whenever we use an Instamatic camera, we think of the name Polaroid. Now let's return to our discussion of today's entrepreneurs. Nowadays, new industries are usually what we call high-tech, you know, computers, electronics, things like that. High-tech industries require creative thinking. That's why today's entrepreneurs often build their businesses near universities. For example, there are many high-tech industries in Boston, near Harvard, MIT, and other respected universities. In California, many high-tech industries are found in an area near San Francisco called Silicon Valley. These industries benefit from being close to Stanford, UC Berkeley, and other universities in the area. In conclusion, all of you probably know someone who started his or her own business. In the United States, we call this person an entrepreneur. We admire and respect this type of person. In fact, entrepreneurs like Stephen Jobs have become a new kind of American cultural hero, like basketball players or movie stars. If you ask a child what he wants to be when he grows up, don't be surprised if he answers, an entrepreneur.
Part 2. Changes in the American family. The traditional American family used to have a working father, a housewife mother, and two or three children. But in the last 20 or 25 years, this picture has changed. Now we have many different kinds of families and living situations besides this traditional one. For example, there are many single mothers and single fathers who are raising children by themselves. There are married couples who decide that they don't want any children. Sometimes adult children who have been living alone for a long time come back and live with their parents again. You can also find groups of older people sharing a house in order to save money. And there are many other examples of new types of families in this country. Why has the traditional family changed so much? Well, the reasons are both social and economic. First, as you know, the divorce rate is high in our culture. As a result, we have many single-parent families. Second, there is unemployment among young adults. If they cannot find a job, many times they return home and live with their parents again. But of course, the most important reason for the changes in the American family is that most American women now work outside the home. In fact, 54.5% of all American women are now working or looking for work. This means that more than half of all American homes do not have a full-time homemaker anymore. With so many women working, our society has some difficult new problems. For example, who will take care of children and old people? Who will do the housework? Who will do volunteer work? Some people might say that these are women's problems, so women should be the ones to solve them. But more and more, people understand that everybody in our society is responsible for trying to find answers to these problems. In fact, many companies are trying to help modern working parents, both the mother and the father, by creating flexible new policies. Here are a few examples. One example is that many companies now allow a woman to leave her job temporarily in order to have a baby. This is called maternity leave. The woman may receive part of her salary while she is not working, and of course, her job will be waiting for her when she is ready to return to work. Second, you know, that big companies like IBM or Mitsubishi often transfer their employees to other cities, right? If a company transfers the husband, for example, this might create a problem for the wife because now she has to find a new job too. Well, now there are some companies that will help the husband or wife or a transferred worker to find a new job. Another new policy is that many companies now have something called flex time. Flex time means that instead of working from 8 a.m. to 5 p.m., as most people do in this country, a worker can work from, say, 6 a.m. to 3 p.m., or from 10 a.m. to 7 p.m., etc. As you can imagine, flex time is very useful for people with children. Many of the big companies in this country now have it. Fourth, some companies allow their employees to work at home instead of coming into the office every day. Working at home is easy for people in professions like computer programming and telephone sales. Fifth, a few large companies now have daycare centers for the children of their employees. I've given you five examples of new company policies that are supposed to make life a little easier for working mothers and fathers. Let me repeat them for you briefly. Maternity leave, helping the wife or husband of a transferred worker to find a new job in another city, flex time, allowing employees to work at home, and daycare centers. However, it's important for you to understand that there are only a few large companies that can afford to help their employees with these kinds of programs. For most people, trying to work and take care of a family is still very, very difficult.
1. What is the traditional American family like?
2. Which of the following is the most important reason for the changes in the American family?
3. What percentage of American women are working outside the home or looking for work?
4. How does a company help a transferred employee?
5. Which of the following statements is true about the policies mentioned in the passage?
Part 3. The Baby Boomer Generation.
Between the end of World War II and the middle of the 1960s, the United States experienced a huge increase in its birth rate. In other words, more babies were born during those 20 years than during any time before or since then. We have a funny name for this increase in the birth rate. We call it the baby boom, and any person born during those years is called a baby boomer. Right now, the oldest members of this generation are in their 40s. This fact is very important because traditionally, the age group with the most money has consisted of people between the ages of 35 and 44. Well, the baby boomers are getting older, and every day, more and more of them are entering this 35 to 44 age group. All this means that the baby boomers are not only the largest age group in the U.S., but they are also the richest. Because of their numbers and their wealth, the baby boomers have tremendous economic power in this country. Although they have a lot of money, the baby boomers do not handle their money in the same way as their parents did. There are three reasons for this. First, you need to remember that the baby boom started after the Second World War during times of inflation. The result of this is that baby boomers usually spend their money instead of saving it like their parents did. Baby boomers are also big users of credit, unlike their parents. Second, the baby boomers never experienced the economic difficulties of the 1930s. They grew up in comfort, even luxury. Finally, baby boomers generally have more leisure time than their parents did. The tastes and preferences of the baby boom generation are also very, very different from those of their parents. And this fact, of course, has influenced American business and industry in many important ways. Let's look at a few examples. What do you think is the biggest expense for people between the ages of 35 and 44? That's right, housing. People in this age group have to borrow a lot of money to pay for houses or condominiums, and they also spend a lot of money on furniture and appliances. So, as more and more baby boomers have entered the 35 to 44 age group, it has been very profitable for banks, furniture manufacturers, interior decorators, and all other businesses connected to housing and home maintenance. People in this age group are also very interested in cars, especially foreign ones. They want cars that are economical, but at the same time, they don't mind spending money for extras like air conditioning, sunroofs, and stereos. The baby boomers are also the largest market for campers and vans, what we call recreational vehicles. The car industry has made a lot of money thanks to the baby boom generation. Now, because the baby boomers are getting older, you can see all around you industries that didn't exist 15 years ago. I'm talking about things like diet centers, tanning salons, and health spas. These businesses are popular because the baby boomers are terribly concerned with staying attractive and healthy as they move into middle age. So these people spend huge amounts of money on physical fitness and beauty. Finally, as the baby boomers grow older, many companies are creating new products designed specifically for middle-aged consumers. For example, several years ago, Levi Strauss started making jeans especially designed for men in their 30s and 40s. Another example, Mattel, which is famous for making toys for kids, now makes electronic toys for adults. A very obvious example of a new product is light beer, which was invented only because baby boomers were afraid of getting fat from drinking regular beer. Even McDonald's is trying to appeal to people in their 30s and 40s by selling salads in addition to hamburgers and french fries. In conclusion, we've seen that the baby boomers, especially those between the ages of 35 and 44, are the largest and richest generation that this country has ever seen. Of course, as this generation grows older, its power and influence will remain. Therefore, we can expect that the economy will continue to change, and business and industry will continue to respond to the special tastes and preferences of this group.
Part 4. Advertising and the media. Let us suppose that a car company, like General Motors, has just come out with a new car. Naturally, GM is eager to sell its new car to the public. But before GM can persuade anybody to buy its new car, it must inform the public about the new product. The best way to do this, of course, is through advertising. No company can hope to make a profit on any product unless it advertises it first. The most important decision that a company has to make regarding advertising is where to advertise. On TV? In magazines? On the radio? In newspapers? We refer to these means of communication as the media. There are three categories of media: print, broadcast, and direct. Today, we are going to describe each of these categories and discuss their importance and usefulness in advertising. The first category, the print media, consists of printed information sources. In other words, newspapers and magazines. For the advertisers, each of these has certain advantages and disadvantages. Let's talk first about newspapers.
which receive more money from advertisements each year than any other medium. This is because newspaper advertising has several outstanding advantages. First of all, nearly everybody reads newspapers. Therefore, newspaper ads reach huge numbers of people. Moreover, newspapers are generally local. This allows small, local businesses to advertise directly to their potential customers. Third, newspaper advertising is relatively cheap, so the ad can be as long as the advertiser wants, and it can also be repeated. These are the advantages of advertising in a newspaper. On the other hand, newspaper ads have no color, and they are not very exciting or glamorous. For the reason, you don't find ads, say, for expensive cars like Porsches in newspapers. Instead, you find these ads in the second type of print medium, magazines. For the advertiser, the greatest advantage of magazines is that they have specialized groups of readers. In other words, the people who read Car and Driver are probably not the same people who read Glamour, which is a woman's magazine, or The New Republic, a political magazine. Obviously, an advertiser will place his ad in the magazine where it will probably be seen by people who are interested in his product. For example, General Motors will advertise its car in Car and Driver, but not in Glamour or The New Republic. So the advantage of advertising in a magazine is that it allows a business to direct its ads to the people who are most interested in the product. The big disadvantage of magazine advertisement is that it can be very expensive, especially in magazines like Playboy or National Geographic. Let's move along now and talk about the broadcast media, by which we mean radio and television. These also have both advantages and disadvantages. First, radio. Radio has two of the same advantages as newspapers. Almost everybody listens to it, and it's usually local. The disadvantages of radio ads are that they must be short and that they are not permanent in the way printed ads are. Millions of dollars are spent each year on radio ads, but millions more are spent on television advertising. You can easily understand why. Of all the media, TV, with sound, movement, and color, is the most dramatic, so the ads are easy to remember. How many of you, for example, can sing the slogan for Coca-Cola? It's the real thing. Television ads are viewed by millions of people all over the country because, first of all, almost everybody watches TV. And second, because most TV programs are broadcast nationally. These are the great advantages of TV advertising. On the other hand, ads on TV are enormously expensive. For example, a 30-second commercial during the evening can cost $150,000. Obviously, only large companies can afford to advertise on television. There is one more category of media that is used extensively in advertising. These are the direct media. The most common direct medium is the mail, and direct mail advertising is a very big business. Even if you have only lived in this country for a short time, you have probably already received advertisements in the mail. The advantage of advertising by mail is that the ad goes directly into potential customers' hands. However, many people don't bother to read these ads. In fact, we call them junk mail and often throw them away without even opening the envelope. Another direct medium is billboards. These are the huge signs that you see whenever you drive down the street. Billboards are useful because they are colorful and easy to see, and the message is permanent, However, the message must be short enough for drivers to read as they are passing by. The third type of direct medium is signs and posters. They are usually used in what is called point-of-purchase advertising. That is, ads that appear in the same place where the product is being sold. You can see point-of-purchase advertising every time you go to the supermarket. There are always signs in the window telling you what is on sale that day. This is also a kind of advertising. Its great advantage is that it is cheap. In summary, we can see that every business, no matter how large or small, depends on advertising to attract and keep customers. Advertisements can be cheap or expensive, long or short, with or without sound and color. It also depends on the type of medium in which they appear. Advertisements are everywhere because the media are everywhere. We cannot escape their influence. They affect us every day of our lives. Part 5. Transportation in the 21st Century.
Let's imagine that an American businessman has to go to Paris on a business trip. On the morning of the trip, he gets into his single-seat car that gets more than 100 miles per gallon. He drives it into an automated moving traffic lane that takes him directly to a rail port or train station. He leaves his car there and gets on a train that travels at 300 miles per hour. Within a few minutes, he arrives at the airport. He and 1,000 other passengers get on a plane that is made almost entirely of plastic. Computers control the plane, which travels at supersonic speed, so our businessman is in Paris in less than 3 hours. Does this description sound fantastic to you? Well, according to transportation experts, we can expect many changes in transportation technology in the 21st century. All the forms of transportation that we use today will still be popular, but they will be very different in design, materials, and technology. In today's lecture, we're going to look at how these familiar modes of transportation will change in the next 50 to 100 years. Naturally, we will start by talking about the automobile, which will still be the most important method of getting around, just as it is today. But of course, we can expect many improvements. First of all, our cars will become totally electronic. They will routinely talk to us, reminding us to turn off our lights, get gas, or fix something. Of course, every car will have a telephone. In addition, the cars of the future will be smaller and more economical. We will probably continue to use gasoline for fuel at least until the end of the century, but gasoline mileage will probably go up to 75 or 100 miles per gallon. Besides the car, several other well-known methods of transportation will be very important as traveling in cities. First, many people will use subways and other rapid transit systems, even though they will be expensive. Second, bus service will increase. The new buses will look different from today's and will be able to carry up to 150 people. During rush hours, they will travel in special bus lanes or maybe even on separate roads, especially for buses. Third, for short trips, there will be many people movers. These are sidewalks that move at 10 or 15 miles per hour. In fact, they already exist today in many modern airports. Now, for long-distance traveling between cities, buses will still be the cheapest way, but they will probably be more comfortable than they are today. Imagine a bus with sleeper seats, video games, movies, and even meal service. Buses will change a lot, but trains will change even more. For one thing, they will be extremely fast. Trains of the future will not travel on rails as they do today. Instead, they will move above the tracks, which will allow them to go as fast as 250 or 300 miles per hour. With such a train, a trip between Milwaukee, Wisconsin, and Chicago, Illinois, would take just half an hour. In the 21st century, people will easily be able to live in one state and work in another. We can conclude that land transportation will be faster and more comfortable than it is today. What about air travel? First, the airplanes of the future will be made of plastic. As a result, they will be quieter, faster, cleaner, and more economical. They will also be larger, carrying up to 1,000 people. Planes will all have computers as pilots, although there will always be a human pilot on the plane in case anything goes wrong. In the passenger area, sleeping arrangements will be more comfortable than they are today. In addition, each passenger will have a private TV set in the back of the seat in front of him. With all these improvements in transportation systems, we can predict that in the 21st century, people will travel more often and farther than they do now. Our world will become a smaller place, and there will probably be much more contact between people from different cultures than there is today.
Part 6. Listening and Translation. 1. Sentence Translation.
1. The company started in 1982. At that time, the personal computer was just a toy and no one was distributing software.
2. I'm just phoning about my visit to London next week. I think we should check everything again.
3. Premiums are collected, but the bogus insurance companies liquidate when big claims are made, leaving clients unprotected.
4. Arrested for illegal possession of arms, the three Americans were remanded in custody until March 26, but their lawyer said they reserved the right to apply for bail to a higher court.
5. The atmosphere of trust and confidence established at the previous talks led him to believe that a joint government and an end to hostilities were within reach.
2. Passage Translation.
1. Well, my bad experience happened some years ago when I was a student and I was with a group of friends on an interrail holiday. And we were sitting in a cafe, and one person had the bag with all the passports and money and everything in it. And we left the cafe, and this person forgot the bag. We then went back to the cafe. The bag wasn't there. So we were desperately upset, as you can imagine. We went to the British Council, and they organized money from our parents and sorted us out, and we were due to fly home the next morning.
2. Anyway, the next morning, on the way to the airport, we were actually on the bus on the way to the airport, and we passed a police station. And as we passed the police station, Mike, one of the people in the group, said, "There's a man walking up the steps of the police station with the bag." And we went, "Don't be daft." And he said, there is. It's the bag." And he was so convincing that he managed to persuade us all to get off the bus and go to the police station. And we went into the police station. He was right. The bag had just been handed in. So we were able to get our passports, our money, our interrail tickets back, and carry on with our holiday.
Unit 16. Part 1. The Effects of the Moon.
The Earth's moon, which has always been an object of worship and mystery to the people of all cultures and religions, is located an average of 239,000 miles from the Earth. It has a diameter of 2,136 miles, and its gravity is one-sixth that of Earth's. Scientists know that the moon, as well as the sun, affects the ocean's tides. It is also possible that the moon is related to the occurrence of earthquakes. But today, we are going to discuss another fascinating question with respect to the moon. Does it affect our behavior? To begin with, many observers say that the moon's phases definitely affect the behavior of animals. For example, fishermen know that fish are easier or harder to catch depending on what stage the moon is in. But what about people? Carl Sagan, the famous astronomer, says, "I have no doubt the moon has an effect on human behavior." There are stories in almost every society about people who do strange and unpredictable things during the time of the full moon, which comes approximately every 29 days. Is there really a connection? Well, one person who believes that the answer to this question is yes is Dr. Arnold Lieber, a psychiatrist in Miami. He has written a book called The Lunar Effect, in which he points out that crime rates seem to increase at the time of the full moon. For example, a woman named Sarah Jane Moore tried to kill former President Gerald Ford during a full moon. Patricia Hearst, the famous heiress, was also kidnapped by a group of terrorists at this time. Dr. Lieber also believes that the full moon is linked to depression in many people. In fact, he points out that in 1977, 9 people committed suicide by jumping off San Francisco's Golden Gate Bridge during full moons. In Los Angeles, some members of the police and fire departments agree that the full moon is associated with more crime and unusual behavior. According to the fire department, the highest number of car accidents occurs on 2 occasions, when welfare checks are distributed and when the moon is full. A Los Angeles police sergeant named Bob Kenny is convinced that the full moon has some effects on people, though he agrees that this is very hard to prove. Still, according to the Los Angeles Times of January 20, 1984, he says that most of the police officers he knows believe there is a connection between crime rates and the full moon. Many airline pilots, waitresses, bartenders, and newspaper reporters, all of whom deal directly with the public, agree that people behave oddly during periods of the full moon, though they can't specify exactly how or why it happens. But of course, there are also plenty of people who disagree. Los Angeles Police Sergeant Dwayne Rasher says that people can behave oddly at any time. He says his workload is no heavier during the full moon. Bar owner Jim Foley agrees with Rasher. People can be erratic at any time, he says. You might want to check the calendar and find out when the full moon will occur in the next few months. During those times, observe the behavior of your family and friends and see if they do anything that is unexplainable or unusual. In the meantime, if it turns out that the moon really does make us all act strangely, let's be thankful that we live on Earth with its one moon and not on Saturn, which has 22 moons, or Jupiter, which has 4 major moons and 12 minor ones. Part 2. The Bermuda Triangle.
On December 5, 1945, at 2 o'clock p.m., a group of 5 United States Navy airplanes took off in perfect weather for a practice flight over the Atlantic Ocean. 2 hours later, the captain of the group, Lieutenant Charles Taylor, radioed back that he was completely lost. He said that the plane's compasses were going crazy and that he could see no land. And then his radio died. The Navy sent another plane to search for the missing group, but it disappeared too. By the end of the day, 6 airplanes and 27 men had disappeared in a mysterious area known as the Bermuda Triangle. This is just one of the many frightening stories that people love to tell about the Bermuda Triangle, which is located in the West Atlantic Ocean between Miami, Florida, the island of Bermuda, and the island of Puerto Rico. Over the years, more than 100 planes, ships, and small boats, and more than 1,000 people have been lost in this area. And in most cases, to make the stories even more mysterious, no wreckage or survivors have ever been found. The planes and ships have simply disappeared. There is no doubt that there is something strange, perhaps even mysterious, about this part of the Atlantic. The question is, what is it? How can we explain the disappearance of so many ships and planes in this region? In this lecture, we will examine some of the official, as well as the more imaginative, explanations that people have offered over the years. The United States Navy does not believe that there is anything mysterious about the triangle. It says that all the accidents are the result of the special geographical features of this area. These features include the Gulf Stream Current, which flows rapidly through the area, many underwater canyons, and changeable, often violent, weather patterns. In addition, the triangle has an unusual magnetic characteristic that causes compasses in this area to point to true north instead of magnetic north. If the navigator of a ship or plane forgets this fact, he can easily get lost in the Bermuda Triangle. The Navy believes that this is probably what happened to the five Navy airplanes that I mentioned at the beginning of this talk. In conclusion, the Navy believes that the disappearances of so many ships and planes can be explained by human error, changing weather, or magnetic abnormalities. Some of the other theories concerning the many accidents in the triangle are a little bit difficult to believe. For example, John Wallace Spencer, who wrote a book called Limbo of the Lost, believes that creatures from outer space have established a civilization in the triangle's underwater canyons, which have never been explored. He thinks that these alien creatures wanted human beings for their underwater zoo, and that they caused the disappearances. A similar theory states that the planes and ships disappeared because unidentified flying objects from outer space, UFOs, attacked them. People who believe this theory refer to the fact that many of the missing planes and ships reported seeing strange white lights before they suddenly disappeared. As you can see, there are many theories to explain the strange things that have happened in the Bermuda Triangle. There have been many books and TV shows about this subject, and there was even a special exposition at the Library of Congress. Nevertheless, thousands of people continue to travel in this popular area. Do these tourists ever wonder if they, too, will disappear in the depths of the Bermuda Triangle?
Part 3. Friends of the Earth.
So, Jonathan Porritt, you're the director of Friends of the Earth, is that right?
That's right. Have been for 3 years.
And what exactly is Friends of the Earth?
It's a campaigning pressure group dealing with a whole series of environmental issues. Some of those are international issues, such as the protection of the rainforests or acid rain. Some are to do with national concerns, such as planning policy or protection of the countryside. A lot of the things that we're involved in are to do with people's ordinary backyard environment, as it were. Small-scale things, like what the individual can do on recycling, or just improving the quality of their own environment. So it covers a wide range of different issues, all the way up, if you like, from the very small personal concerns right through to the biggest international issues.
About big international issues, what do you see as the most important environmental issues of the moment?
It's quite difficult to make a kind of hierarchy of worry here, because so many issues are there, and they're all very, very important. But I think it has to be said that as far as we're concerned, as a campaigning organization, it really is the rainforest that we are concentrating on most. If we don't take action on that issue within the next 5 years, then environmental pressure groups won't have anything to do in 10 years' time. Because there won't be any rainforests, really, for them to campaign about. So this is a critical period for the rainforests, the next 5 years, and there's enough flexibility in the system to allow us to hope that we're going to be able to make some changes during that time. So that's why we've made it our priority.
What's so important about the rainforests, then? What's the difference between having them or not having them? Isn't it just, basically either there's a lot of trees there or there aren't a lot of trees there?
Well, that's what some people would like to think. I think President Reagan was famous for saying, seen one tree, seen them all. And basically, this is not the attitude that we have. It's important in many different ways. Important, firstly, for the countries themselves, in terms of the fact that millions of people depend on the rainforests for their livelihood and for the quality of their environment through the protection of watersheds and so on. Secondly, they're important because of the biological richness of the rainforests. A genetic chest, a treasure chest, is how they have been described. More than 60% of the world's species
is to be found in the rainforests. Write that off, and you write off the genetic storehouse. Lastly, they're important at an international level because of the impact on climatic patterns that one would find if the rainforests were destroyed. So whether you're looking closely at the tribal people who depend on them, the countries which depend on them, the international community which depends on them, indeed, the creatures themselves, it's actually the most critical issue that we face. And our prime job is, of course, to try and get people to understand how it is, even in countries where there are no rainforests, that they still have a connection with the rainforests. Part 4, Acid Rain. I'm going to talk about acid rain, a subject which many people have heard of, but very few understand fully. I'm going to talk about exactly what acid rain is and why it's a problem, and then I'm going to finish off by saying what we can do about it, what the solutions are now, and what the solutions will be in the future, in the long term. So, first of all, acid rain is a term that's really being used now for a kind of pollution which is hanging over our heads, in a sense. It's the air pollution above us. It's the pollution that's coming down in rain, in mist, in snow, in hail, in many different ways, and damaging our forests, our lakes and rivers, our buildings, and even human health. If we are to control acid rain, we must know what is actually causing it. So now I'm going to talk about the chemicals involved. There are really three we should look at. These are sulfur dioxide, nitrogen oxides, and ozone. The first two of those are primary pollutants. That is, they are produced directly from source. In the case of sulfur dioxide, the main problem is power station chimneys. In the case of nitrogen oxides, they come really half and half from cars and from power stations. Ozone is what's known as a secondary pollutant. It means it's formed in the atmosphere from a combination of other pollutants, other primary pollutants. Ozone is formed from a combination of nitrogen oxides and hydrocarbons, both of which come from car exhausts. If you put sunlight onto these two chemicals, they react together and they form ozone, and so the highest levels of ozone are found in a hot summer around the edges of cities where there are lots of car exhausts, lots of sunlight, and then you end up with a lot of ozone. I think the one that most people would associate with acid rain, if they know anything about it at all, is sulfur, and particularly sulfur dioxide. About 71% of all sulfur dioxide emitted from Britain comes from the large coal-burning power stations predominantly situated in the Midlands. In fact, Britain is Western Europe's largest emitter of sulfur dioxide. We put out some 3.7 million tons a year. That's more than any other country, except perhaps Poland or Russia, if you go to the East Bloc. The problem, of course, with sulfur dioxide is that it doesn't fall close to the factory or the power station. It gets lifted into the air, and it can travel thousands of miles in the air before it falls as rain. So we're not just creating a problem for ourselves. We're creating a problem for the rest of Europe. And that is really why the Scandinavians and the Dutch and the Belgians have become angry with the British government, because it hasn't done anything about acid rain, because they are paying for the environmental damage which is caused by our pollution. But we shouldn't think that all our pollution goes out of the country. Our environment is dying as well. And sulfur from our power stations is landing all over the United Kingdom. In Wales and in the west of Scotland, acid rain is already having quite a marked effect. Some hundreds of lakes in Wales have been affected. Several have lost their fish, and in the west of Scotland, 27 Galloway lakes have already completely lost their fish. Now, perhaps I should go on to some of the solutions that we should be looking to stop this environmental catastrophe. There are short-term solutions, and there are long-term solutions. In the short term, we need to make immediate cuts to the emissions that are coming from our power stations and cars. In the long term, we need to change the way society is thinking. Many people have heard of the 30% Club. This is a group of now some 22 nations which have agreed to cut their sulfur emissions by 30% on 1980 levels by the year 1993. Britain hasn't yet joined the 30% Club. Some of the other countries that have are Sweden, Norway, Canada, West Germany, the Netherlands. Even Russia has joined the 30% Club. This is only the first step on the road to effective sulfur emission control. And what we really want to see is reductions of between 60 and 90% over the next 10 years or so. And looking to the longer term, we shouldn't just rely on solutions that involve a technological fix. We shouldn't just clean up power station chimneys and car exhausts. What we need to do is change the way society thinks and reacts. The first thing that needs to be done is we need to use less energy. One way of using less energy is to increase recycling, and so recycling schemes and reuse of materials should be encouraged throughout Europe and North America. Secondly, we have to change our transport system. We have to look for a more efficient transport system which relies less on the individual's use of cars and more on a good public transporter network. These are the things we must be looking forward to. Unless we do that, unless we change society in this way, conserve energy, rationalize our way of transport, and now clean up our power stations and individual cars, then we're bound to see more and worse environmental effects from air pollution and acid rain. We must act now.